Welcome to People's Pensions, the podcast that discusses how to improve pension provision for savers across the UK.
The triple lock is the government's policy.
We've attacked our pension funds.
Because pension credit can make a huge difference.
Each episode, Phil Brown will be joined by experts from inside and outside the industry to look at some of the big issues in pensions and discuss how to ensure people have enough to live on once they finish working.
We make sure that money goes into the account.
They have over 5 million members.
I want to be comfortable when I get old.
Pension providers always need to be on the lookout for the best way to invest their members' money. Pick the right investments, and people will get larger pension pots when they come to retire. Of course, get it wrong, and the opposite happens. Well, there's a new industry which wants to attract more investment from pension funds, the life sciences industry. That's the industry which comes up with new drugs to keep us healthy and which proved its worth during the COVID pandemic. The UK has a great track record of coming up with ideas, but there's a lack of financial backing, forcing startup companies to go abroad. Today, Phil Brown talks to a life science expert to ask whether pension providers are letting down UK life science companies by being too slow to get on board.
Good afternoon and welcome to our latest podcast. Today I have Dr. Dan Mahoney with me, who is chair of the UK Bioindustry Association and last year was appointed as the Life Sciences Investment Envoy for the government. Dan, it's probably best if you introduce yourself because I'm not going to do kind of life sciences the justice it deserves if I introduce you being a pension professional. So welcome and hello.
Thanks for having me, Phil. Sort of a brief career history is I actually started life as a scientist. So in the mid 90s, after I finished my PhD in Cambridge, I was part of the brain drain. I went to California to a biotechnology company, did that, was working in a lab for 4 years on cancer drug discovery. And then I completely shifted gear careers in the only way you can do in the US, which is I ended up moving from San Francisco to New York to work for an investment bank. Where I was an analyst at a small boutique focused on healthcare. And I came back to London in 2000 to work for Morgan Stanley, where I was a sell-side research analyst covering biotechnology in the healthcare sector. Then in 2007, before the financial crisis, in a moment of genius, which turns, decided to start a fund, which maybe wasn't a great idea, but sort of 18 months later, but I started a healthcare fund at a place called Polar Capital that I ran for 15, 16 years. And when I stepped down from there, we were running about £3 or £4 billion just in healthcare. So I've spent the last 25 years investing or analysing investments just in the healthcare space, particularly in biotechnology and life sciences.
That's really interesting. Thank you. Interesting to have that perspective of life sciences and also the investment angle too. We'll come back to that later on. I think it would be useful just by way of getting the conversation going, if we thought about the fact that at the moment there's a lot of discussion around UK pensions and use of the words illiquid assets, meaning a catch-all for a variety of different kinds of investments. So biotechnology is probably a specific kind of subset of that whole area. And it would be interesting to understand the challenges that kind of life sciences have and what this brings to life sciences, as well as the ability to potentially produce bigger returns for pensions.
So I'm a glass half full person, so challenges to me are sometimes opportunities as well. So I think particularly, and if we just talk about companies in the UK, but actually some of these are true more generally. If anything, one big challenge for companies right now is the pace of innovation. So I'm sure you're hearing about things like ChatGPT, et cetera, AI. All of those technologies can be applied to understanding biology better and developing new therapeutics or new diagnostic tools to potentially identify disease much earlier than we can today. And that pace of innovation is a challenge, because what you want to do as a small company is translate that great academic science into products or services that ultimately have an impact on people's lives. Now, to do that, you need money. And I think that sort of, because everything's moving so fast, you can't take the slow and steady, we'll just spend a few quid, see how it goes, because otherwise better funded peers or competitors will go rushing past you. And if you like, a first mover advantage that you've got today could evaporate within 2 or 3 years if you don't prosecute it fully. And I think the unique challenge for life sciences companies, particularly sort of ones trying to develop drugs, is you can't bootstrap your way like you can in tech with revenue growth, because obviously you have a regulator. I have to run a load of clinical trials before I can actually sell a drug. And the further you go through the clinical trial process, the more expensive it gets, because you start off running a test in 10 people, then 100, then 1,000. So the costs increase, but obviously you can't generate any revenue. And so these companies have quite a large appetite for capital. But once you get a product to market, they're incredibly profitable, particularly if you're starting to cure diseases. They're very profitable and you can get sort of, they're proper global businesses. You can sell that product or that drug all the way around the world. So they're sort of classic high risk, high reward opportunities.
That's interesting. And I guess you're alluding to one of the areas that pension funds, and specifically those that sort of manage the investments and do the due diligence around those funds, would have to work with. And that's understanding and almost calibrating the opportunities that are out there and how those would sit in terms of risk profile and length of investment. And there could be a challenge in the number of different skills one might need to assess the different investment opportunities. So is there ways that these opportunities can be brought to funds that don't involve an investment manager or a pension fund having to upskill in a very specific area of bioscience or medicine?
I would argue that it's unlikely that a pension fund is going to be a direct investor in any early stage biotechnology business, just for that level of expertise. And interestingly, even if you look at the venture community itself, you have some people who are specialized at the seed series A, so setting these companies up. You've got other people who are specialized at sort of taking they'll do series B, series C investments. So taking it from, say, 20 people to 100 people, getting a drug into a clinic. And then you've got other people who specialize on investing in the later stage clinical trials, taking things to market. So if the actual specialist investors are segmented and specialized, the pension fund who sits above them obviously is allocating capital down to those venture capital fund managers. You know, that's probably a step too far for them to be a direct investor. But what I would point out is it's very rare that sort of you would start on, you know, you and me in your garage sort of cooking up a drug and doing the full 15 years to get it to the clinic. There are various ways that you can get exits along that path, not least you've got a big pharmaceutical industry that has a voracious appetite for new products and are always either licensing those drug candidates or buying those companies. So you don't, while you're right, there is a long time frame. It's not as if you have to wait the full 15 years to get the returns.
That's really interesting. So what we're looking at in essence is, I'm not tying this to one mechanism, because it could be a fund of funds where you have specialists sat in within an investment house. I mean, it could also be something like the Australian model, where they have effectively a pension fund or pension investor, as in the owner of the pension asset, focused manager that actually does sort of the market making in between investors and funds. So there's obviously a variety of ways of doing that, and I guess the thing we've got to get through is how we bring those to market to actually provide those opportunities to pension funds, because that's probably the piece of the investment network that's almost missing at the moment.
I think that's fair. So one of the tasks I was set as the life science investment envoy was trying to rebuild the finance ecosystem. And so I would argue, if you go back 20, 25 years, so sort of late 90s, when sort of biotech, if you like, reared its head seriously for the first time, we sort of had that ecosystem in the sense that you had a public market, so you could IPO companies in the UK, and you had different sorts of investors or asset allocators allocating capital, if you like, into the different sleeves of risk that would go from an early stage to a late stage. We still have some of those players, but it feels as though some have disappeared or sort of have shrunk, and sort of that ecosystem probably, it's like one of those rope ladders you see in sort of in the jungle where a few of the slats are missing and you might have to make a jump to sort of get from A to B. So I think that is missing a bit. And I think what you talk about, so we had one of the Australian Supers as one of our clients when I was at Polar. And sort of the way they thought about things is they looked at healthcare sort of as a vertical they wanted to be invested in. And some of the capital they had allocated was in sort of more of a passive vehicle. Then they had some active vehicles in public markets. And then they also were doing bits and pieces in venture capital, if you like, to build a sleeve that sort of essentially meant they were investing across the whole of healthcare, but they could manage the risk they wanted to take, how much they allocated, if you like, to each piece, but also enabled them to sort of manage sort of the fee structure of that, because obviously the passives are a lot cheaper. It meant they could pay the higher fees to the VC bit, because that might only have been, say, 5-10% of their entire healthcare allocation. But it gave them sort of some control, but also meant they had exposure across the whole breadth of healthcare, which meant they got sort of ultimately much better risk-adjusted returns.
And I think therein lies one of our opportunities, as you said earlier, to improve in the UK. We have a vast array of pension types, and I would say quite a fractured pension industry with lots of different elements to it. Whereas in Australia, I think it's a lot more focused, and you've got some very big supers. And I think one of the things we need to focus on here is actually how do we get those asset pools to the right sizes to actually make meaningful investments in these kind of assets, or how do we put the vehicle in between the asset and the pension fund that does that while we're working out sort of the structure of the market, because we have literally thousands of relatively small funds across the UK.
Yeah, I agree with that. But at the same time, I don't think you want, if you like, and I'm not sure that you're suggesting this, three super funds for the entire UK, because actually, at some point, you get to, you know, one of the challenges, if I go out to, say, raise a venture fund of £500 million, no one really wants to be more than 10% of that. So the biggest ticket I'm going to take is, say, £50 million. Well, if you're running 500 billion, 50 million is a rounding error. And so you run into the problem that if the asset allocator or the super fund is so big, it can't allocate to the right size of fund. So, and the reason is that I'm a big believer in you need the right size funds for the assets you're investing in. So if I'm doing seed startup investing, where sort of it might be the first stage of a biotech company that raised £5 million, maybe £10 million, it's very difficult to do that out of a £1 billion fund, because then I'm doing 100 investments. And I guarantee that investment number 100 is going to be far worse than investment number one if you deploy that capital over a 2 or 3 year period. So I think it's important. I agree that we do need some consolidation, but I don't think that should go too far. We still need that diversity just because of the nature of the underlying funds and also the nature of the underlying investments that one wants to make.
Interesting. I take your point about getting to sort of the supersized investment vehicles. There's a question that comes to mind, and I'm hesitating how to ask it, because it's so do we have an environment where we could get on with this, or do we need some form of intervention to actually help the market get to this? Does that make sense?
Let me answer that in this way. So what I observe at the moment is we have, and entrepreneurs would possibly disagree, but I think we've got a decent amount of startup capital out there right now coming from either high net worths or family offices. So what I mean is, if you wanted to raise 5 to say £15 million, there are sources of that capital out there. So we're starting a lot of companies, and that's great. And those companies are making progress, etc. What we don't have is a group of investors in what we call the growth capital phase. So if I need to go and raise £50 to £100 million because I want to run a couple of clinical trials, that's the kind of quantum of capital that you need. There aren't many doors you can go and knock on. And what we're seeing, certainly in UK life sciences, and I think this is probably true in tech too, is that capital at the moment is being garnered from overseas investors. And so what's happening is we've got the opportunity set sitting here in the UK on our doorstep. And actually, people overseas have seen that. They're coming in, making those investments, and they're making the returns. And so we're losing those investment returns, if you like, for either unit holders or future pensioners or whatever, because the capital isn't coming from the UK. And so I think that's a lost opportunity. And so to your question, does that need to be regulated? Well, I think there are certain rules that might be preventing people from investing in those illiquid private companies related to Solvency II, et cetera, you know, depending on sort of what type of asset allocator you are, insurance companies, et cetera. And I don't think that it's for the government to sort of bang its fist on the table and say, you must invest in UK companies. I think it's more that let's loosen, if you like, the screws that allow people to take risk on the pension side, and then show them the opportunities that are sitting there. And then it's up to the asset allocators to say, actually, I'm not interested in that, or, wow, I didn't realize these opportunities were here. How do I get access to that asset class? And sort of then, sort of, if you like, the ball starts rolling.
Interesting. I like the way kind of you're articulating that. So when you were referring to garnering assets from overseas or investment from overseas, you yourself obviously went to Silicon Valley for quite a while, as you said. That one of the challenges that comes with that overseas investment is if you're going to be listed overseas, then like your main workforce and manufacturing things has to move overseas too, doesn't it? And that's probably giving the continued brain drain that you were talking about.
Certainly when you look at the drug space, the most profitable and the biggest market is the United States. I mean, that's true for a lot of products, but it's certainly true. So while I can sell a drug all over the world, I'll make most of my money in the US. And so at some point, also, if you look at the UK in terms of the global drug market is about $1.4 trillion, something like that. UK is about 3% of the market. So, you know, just, well, what, 60 million people. So you're always going to have to export. The problem is, if we aren't applying the growth capital here, what happens is you've got, say, the spinner, the company that's created from a professor in Cambridge. She's got them to sort of 30, 40 people, so super smart people. They've invented something. When the growth capital goes in, then that company, they might leave the 30 people in Cambridge, but the next 100 they hire will be in Cambridge, just outside Boston, because that's where they're going to manufacture the drug. That's where they're going to sell the drug. And so actually the company, if you like, gets transplanted much earlier than maybe it could do. Whereas if we can sort of get that company growing from 30 to 100, 200 people here, a good example of that is a company in Oxford called Adaptimmune. They now have 250 PhD scientists in Oxford. They're developing a cancer drug that will be sold in the US. They do have US operations. But they've built much deeper roots here, which means there are, you know, for the UK economy, there are better jobs here. But it also, that's where the returns can be made. And so I think that it's a combination of the UK economy is missing out and the UK pensioner is missing out. And, you know, both of those are pretty bad.
Yeah, and this is an area that has political support from the government and the opposition. So it's, you know, it's a conversation you hear regularly. Do you think, so we've referred to, we don't think there's necessarily regulatory intervention needed, but what needs to change in the ecosystem for this to actually become the activity we're all engaged in rather than the conversation we're having? Because it feels like there's almost like a catalyst missing somewhere that really gets it going.
What I have been arguing is that there are two aspects to this. There's the release of capital and there's the deployment of capital. So what I mean by the release of capital, which could be that, for argument's sake, I'm not suggesting this, but the government says every pension fund should put 10% of its capital into illiquid UK investments. I don't think they're going to do that, but that would release capital fairly obviously. And I think that sort of some of the rules need to be changed. I think that some of the requirements of trustees and pensions maybe we need to look at the fiduciary duty of trustees, which isn't necessarily just to get the lowest cost pension, but actually to try and get the best value for money, which is the best return for those pensioners. But sort of if we can get that release of capital to come, I think you have to trust that the City of London is still pretty vibrant and people appear with opportunities, investment opportunities for that capital to be deployed. And you'll get all ranges of that from, say, fund of funds, which might be very helpful for someone who's a smaller pension fund without the in-house expertise to actually analyse individual funds, down to someone who specialises into just fintech or maybe in sort of biotech terms, just dementia drugs. I mean, you could be into sort of very narrow, very specialist areas, which if you're an asset allocator who's got the capability to analyse those funds and that opportunity in that market, then maybe you could allocate directly to those. And so I think the deployment, and what's interesting is with some of the noise that you're seeing in the press and some of the conversations that you, your colleagues and your peers have been having, it's a classic case of, you know, Keynes's animal spirits. The people I'm talking to in the city are quite excited because they feel as, not that they feel there's a wave of money coming towards them, but it's like, we've got great opportunities here and great ideas. How can you introduce us to the people who've got the money that they could allocate towards us? And then sort of you get the virtuous circle that starts going. So I think what needs to happen is sort of, if you look at, not wanting to pick people out, but if I look at M&G, for instance, if you remember, they bought the Prudential business, you know, umpteen years ago, those with profits funds. So they have the ability, they created something called the Catalyst Fund, which is £5 billion of that 100 or so billion pound pot that they got, that they're investing with a 25-year view. And they're focusing on clean tech and they're focusing on healthcare. And they're beginning to deploy capital. So I think what you sort of need is not really so much a regulatory push, maybe it needs a regulatory nudge, but also you see your peer group are suddenly dipping their toe into the market, they're allocating capital, and they're beginning to make returns. And that sort of is also what sort of brings people on board, that if everybody else is doing it, then maybe I should take a look at, actually, this is an asset class that maybe I should get some exposure to.
That's an interesting point you're making there, because there's a number of relatively big asset holders in the UK where you're talking hundreds of millions, or in kind of a couple of cases you're getting up to sort of £1 trillion assets. I think that the challenge for me, I'm not sure fiduciary duty is a burden or a barrier. I think what happens with fiduciary duty is it has an implication on the size of the fund. So the smaller the fund, the more challenging it is to make that investment. So yeah. It brings us back around to not consolidation as a theme, but fund size. So maybe it's the vehicles that sit in between the fund and the investment that can help solve that, where there are multiple smaller funds. But it's definitely an area that won't go away. And I guess I'll give you the last couple of words. So what are the two or three things you think we, as an industry, we should be doing? And that can either be from your experience in biosciences or your experience as I was going to call you a reformed fund manager then, an ex-fund manager. Just so.
Resting.
Resting, that's the word, yeah.
So I think there's one really important point there as well, Phil, is that what you don't want is, so we've got whatever it is, £4.6 trillion sitting in pensions. The worst thing to happen is suddenly, okay, we need 10% of that in illiquid investments, and suddenly 460 billion drops on the market in a year. That would be disastrous, because you've got, the market couldn't take all that capital, all the prices will go up, and no one would make any returns. So actually what you really want is, you actually want a classic sort of launch of, I've seen this with the launch of drugs. You have the early adopters, you have the growth phase, and then you have the naysayers who, you know, are the last to come to the party. You sort of need that in the pensions industry. You need some of the early adopters who start dripping capital out, but you don't want it all to happen in 2 years. We want this to happen over a 5 to 10 year kind of process, as it were, so that capital is available for companies, but doesn't all flow at one time. because I think that means that it will be absorbed by the underlying companies, and it also means that the investors will make the appropriate returns. You don't kind of get this like artificial bubble in the short term.
Really interesting, and a great kind of point for us to draw a conclusion. I'm sure we could go on longer, but Dan, thank you very much for your time today. A really interesting subject, as I say, one that won't go away at the moment, and quite rightly is getting a lot of focus in the media and in industry discussions. Thank you for your time.
No problem, Phil. Anytime. Thanks a lot.
That was People's Pensions with Phil Brown. If you've enjoyed this podcast, please subscribe on your preferred platform or through the People's Pension website to make sure you never miss an episode.